I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, a woman talks about her 10-year journey to fulfill her mother's last wish. That's our Washington Post magazine story, and we'll have that in just a few minutes. But first, there is grim news out of Mexico, and this is probably a good place to point out that the details are gruesome and so might not be appropriate for all listeners. With that being said, on Sunday, authorities found nearly 50 decapitated and dismembered bodies along a highway about 80 miles southwest of the U.S. border. Officials say the murders appear to be related to an ongoing war between Mexican drug cartels. Back in 2006, Mexican President Felipe Calderón announced a crackdown on the cartels. Since then, more than 47,000 people have been killed in drug-related violence throughout Mexico. But we want to focus today on one particular target, and that is journalists. An alarming number of journalists have been killed recently in just one area, Veracruz, Mexico. Earlier this month, Mexican military police recovered the dismembered bodies of three press photographers from a canal in the Mexican port city. All had shown signs of torture. The body of the girlfriend of one of the men was found alongside them. These deaths come soon after the death of another Veracruz journalist, Regina Martinez. She was a crime and investigative reporter for the national news magazine Proceso. In all, seven Veracruz journalists have been killed in the past 14 months, along with some members of their families. We wanted to know more about this, so earlier we called Jose de Cordoba. He is a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. He's based in Mexico City, and he's been reporting on these attacks on journalists. Also joining us was Carlos Loria. He is a senior program coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Gentlemen, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Nice to be here, Michelle.
Now, Jose, you've been in Mexico for some time, and Mexico has long been known as a dangerous place for reporters to work, so I think a lot of people understand that. But why Veracruz? Why now? Why these people?
Well, Veracruz has become a battleground for two of Mexico's most dangerous and most violent drug cartels in the last year and a half, I would say. It's a seaport, the city of Veracruz, and it's a strategic place on the routes taking drugs north. It's been controlled by the Zetas, and now the Sinaloa cartel is fighting the Zetas for control of Veracruz.
And Jose, how is this being reported in Mexico, or does it fall to the international press to report on this?
Well, Mexico has gotten to the point where unless there's a lot of, you know, there's a massacre with a lot of people being killed, it doesn't make much news. Where the country has been caught in this spiraling cycle of violence since 2007, where just incredibly hideous things don't shock as much as they used to. In Veracruz, for example, I mean, the worst incident was last September when the bodies of 35 people were thrown out in the middle of the city center, right next to a convention hotel that was going to be the site of a convention for the state's Mexican state's attorney generals the next day. But the result of all this has been an enormous amount of self-censorship among Mexican regional newspapers. It's still reported in Mexican national papers and Mexican national media, but local papers really do censor themselves almost out of the business.
Carlos Loria, what kind of context would you put this in? I think people understand that, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, those are war zones, are dangerous places for journalists. But can you compare, and also maybe by extension Pakistan, but how does the situation in Mexico compare to those, if you don't mind putting it on those terms?
Sure. So. I mean, since President Calderón took office in December of 2006, more than 45 journalists have been killed or disappeared in Mexico. Media outlets have been bombed. Journalists have gone into exile or abandoned their profession. But I will say that perhaps the most devastating consequences of this wave of unprecedented violence in Mexico is a climate of fear and intimidation in which journalists work, which is leading to, as Jose pointed out, widespread censorship. Many of the issues that affect the daily lives of thousands of Mexicans, including journalists, are being unreported. So this is a problem that has gone way beyond the press. It's a problem that is affecting fundamental human rights of Mexicans, freedom of expression and access to information, and is inhibiting the debate on issues of public interest, the impact of violence, the collusion between organized crime and authorities, All these issues are not covered. Journalists are terrified. I think that democratic stability is at risk. Mexico has become one of the most dangerous places for journalists around the world.
We mentioned that Regina Martinez is a correspondent for Proceso magazine. She was reporting on the crime cartels, or at least attempting to. But Jose, were the other journalists who were killed, were they in fact doing this kind of reporting? It's my understanding that one of the people who was killed wasn't even working in journalism anymore.
Yeah, there were two photojournalists who were still working as photographers. One had given up and become a welder. But the thing is that all these guys work the police beat, and that's a very, very dangerous profession to do in Mexico, especially in the states that have become battlegrounds between warring cartels. We don't know specifically what Guillermo Luna or Gabriel Uge were working on before their death, but the mere fact that you're taking pictures of any crime scene in Mexico has become dangerous in these areas because you don't know who might not want you to take that photograph. Or sometimes you do know who doesn't want you to take that photograph or report that story.
We're talking about a string of brutal attacks on journalists in Mexico. 7 journalists have been murdered just in Veracruz in the last 14 months. I'm joined by Jose de Cordoba. He's a Wall Street Journal reporter based in Mexico City who's been reporting on this. Also with us, Carlos Lauria of the Committee to Protect Journalists. That's an organization that keeps track of attacks on journalists around the world. And Jose, you cannot help but note that there just seem to be no boundaries here at all. I mean, we noted that the photojournalists, there were clear signs that they had been tortured when their bodies were discovered. They were dismembered. I apologize for the fact that this is gruesome, but it's a fact. And in addition to that, in one case, a journalist's family was killed along with him. Is the level of brutality here intended to send a message, or has that just become the new normal as well?
I think it's intended to send a message, and unfortunately it's become the new normal. I think obviously there are terror tactics meant to send a message, because many of the times, you know, groups, they will leave a sign saying, you know, we're the Zetas and we're here or whatever. So there are signs meant to terrorize the citizens, local law enforcement, everybody, that the real powers are whatever drug gang has done the killing.
Carlos Lauria, has there been any governmental response to this? I understand that the Mexican Senate approved a constitutional amendment to federalize anti-press crimes. Is that perceived as important? And are there other steps that your organization is advocating that would address this?
Right. Well, I think that one of the problems that aggravates this free expression crisis in Mexico is the fact that over 90% of the cases are not prosecuted. Those responsible for these horrendous crimes are not going to jail. So impunity is a huge problem. In part, this is responsibility of the federal government because, you know, these are fundamental human rights that are enshrined in the Constitution and in international treaties that have been ratified by Mexico. I think that reforms need to happen, and this, federalization of crimes against free expression, which will give federal authorities broader jurisdiction to prosecute and investigate these crimes, is a positive step forward, because most of these crimes now rely on the hands of state authorities, and the penetration of organized crime in the states is huge. So I think this is a step forward. But we have to understand that there's no magic solutions, no silver bullet that will stop the violence of the cartels, and this will take time. There are other mechanisms that the state can put in place, like imminent protection for journalists that are an imminent risk, which, you know, the federal government has tried to put in place but has been very ineffective. I think this new law will provide a better framework, but it will take time, and there's a need, urgent need, for successful prosecutions.
And finally, this is an election year in Mexico. A new president will be selected at some point. Is this an issue?
Well, I think, this should be an issue. You know, it's a grave press freedom crisis, which is inhibiting debate on very important issues, and I haven't seen any of the candidates take on these issues. And, you know, the federal government, Calderon government, has said that this is a priority in his national agenda. Unfortunately, you know, the government has been overwhelmed. The drug traffickers have become the de facto authorities in many places in Mexico, and journalists, you know, cannot do their work. They have no guarantees, and they are terrified. But it would be very important for the candidates to debate on these issues and to take a position, to know what will the candidates do when they come to the presidency.
Jose, did you want to give a final thought? Give a final thought there.
No, yes, I was going to say, this is the underlying issue. It's the basic issue that Mexico will have to deal with in the following years. And it has an enormous amount to do with the enormous corruption that afflicts a lot of Mexico's, you know, the judicial institution, the Mexican police force, and Mexican prisons. And until Mexico solves all that, it will not really be able to progress as much as it should.
Jose de Cordoba is a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal based in Mexico City. He's been reporting on the brutal attacks on journalists in Mexico, most recently in Veracruz. He was with us on the phone from Mexico City. Also with us, Carlos Loria. He's with the Committee to Protect Journalists and focuses on Latin America. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, it's really not a secret that America's waistlines are getting bigger. And there's a new study out that says more than 40% of Americans will be obese in the next 20 years if nothing changes. It's also not news that African Americans and Latinos are at higher risk. So what's new? Maybe the way we are talking about it. Later in the program, we are going to speak with two women who are trying to change the conversation around excess weight in a way that gets beyond cliches and hopefully gets people to pay attention. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we turn to Chicago and a verdict in a local case that made headlines and caused some sober reflections around the country and in the city. Actress and singer Jennifer Hudson grew up in Chicago's Englewood neighborhood that's on the city's south side before she rose to stardom. She became a finalist on American Idol and later won an Oscar for her role in the movie Dreamgirls. And she's also become an enthusiastic spokesperson for weight loss and healthy living. But that Cinderella story has been punctuated by a truly awful chapter. In 2008, her mother, brother, and nephew were killed. On Friday, William Balfour, the estranged husband of Jennifer Hudson's sister Julia, was convicted of those crimes. He reportedly committed the murders because he was angry that she was dating another man. But the conversations around that story have not been the ones you might expect. Our next guest is telling us that residents aren't asking how this could happen in the family of a famous actress, but rather, why is this happening to so many people? We wanted to talk more about this. We've called Natalie Moore. She is a reporter for member station WBEZ in Chicago, and she paid close attention to the trial. Natalie, thanks so much for joining us once again.
It's great to be back.
Now, I mentioned that the neighborhood where Jennifer Hudson grew up is also the home of the NBA superstar Derrick Rose. Could you tell us a little bit about the neighborhood and what's been going on there?
Yes, and also Bernie Mac grew up in Inglewood. My office is in the Inglewood neighborhood where I cover the South Side and urban issues. It's one of these areas that you often hear about when it comes to violence, unemployment, health disparities. It's mostly Black, poor, and segregated and under-resourced. Now, that's not the complete narrative of this neighborhood. There are strong Block clubs. There are people who go to work and pay taxes, which, you know, to some people may sound radical because Inglewood is really painted with this broad stroke. There's a community council there. There are people who are really trying to better the neighborhood, but violence continues to mar the neighborhood.
But it's been reported that at a time when cities across the country have seen the number of homicides fall, sometimes dramatically, that in Chicago, you know, homicides, for example, jumped by a whopping 60% in the first 3 months of 2012, and the violence in Inglewood is is a very big part of that. Why, Natalie? Why is this happening? I mean, people generally tend to believe it's related to gangs and, you know, gang-related violence and drugs. But is it really that in your reporting?
I wouldn't say that it's gang-related. I think there has to be some context around violent neighborhoods. And Inglewood certainly is one of the most violent in Chicago, and crime has seen an uptick. But overall, crime is down in Chicago compared to 20 years ago. That doesn't mean that you overlook the violence that is happening. It doesn't mean that Inglewood isn't one of the most violent neighborhoods. But I think when you're looking for solutions— policymakers, residents, block club presidents have to understand the larger picture that's here. I would say, you know, the neighborhoods that have violence tend to be under-resourced neighborhoods. There are a lot of other things that are going on. The unemployment rate is much higher in Inglewood. I talked about the health disparities. You know, any disease, you know, diabetes, heart disease, it's going to be higher for residents in Inglewood than in other places. There are food deserts, meaning that you can't find a place to really get groceries or fresh food. So when you compound all those issues, it makes sense that this would be one of the most violent neighborhoods because of the lack of resources and the high unemployment. So that's my take on it. When people talk about gangs, it's usually interpersonal violence among young black men, not so-called gang violence. But you are right. Drugs are a huge issue. Drug users, drug selling. I would say that supersedes this idea of gangs.
Well, you also talked about the fact that it's kind of a vicious cycle because people who can leave do leave. I mean, Jennifer Hudson herself personally does not live there. Derek Rose personally does not live there anymore, although family members still do. I'm joined by Chicago Public Radio's Natalie Moore. We're talking about the trial of William Balfour. He was convicted on Friday of killing Jennifer Hudson's mother and nephew. Talk a little bit about the trial, if you would. Apparently, at one point, the judge received a letter from the or note from the jurors saying that they were having difficulty coming to a decision. Why is that?
Well, there was a lot of circumstantial evidence in this case. There was very little physical evidence against William Balfour for killing the mother, brother, and nephew of Jennifer Hudson. And we live in a world where we hear about DNA and fingerprints and CSI, all of these things that are in our lexicon. And fingerprints and DNA were not found at the crime scenes of William Balfour, but the timeline was there. You know, he was seen in the neighborhood. Witnesses testified that they saw him with the same handgun that was used in the murders, and others testified that they heard him make threats about Julia Hudson, that was his estranged wife, and the family. Mm. And the jurors talked about they just really wanted to piece the timeline together, and they relied on the cell phone records. And they said wherever those records say that he was, that's where he was. And his alibi fell apart. He wasn't where he said that he was. And that's one of the things that won the jurors over.
Jennifer Hudson was in the courtroom during the trial, and that did get a lot of attention. I just want to play a clip from Cook County Prosecutor Anita Alvarez.
Her mother, her brother, and her nephew were killed. She's a victim. Victims' families are sitting in the hard seats each and every day in this courthouse watching trials of where their loved ones were killed. So her celebrity status had nothing to do with the fact that she was there. It was the love of her family.
But do you think that her celebrity status played any role in how the case was handled or in how the jurors perceived it? It sounds as if they really struggled hard in it, so perhaps not. What's your take?
Many of them have said that Jennifer Hudson's stardom did not play a factor. But at the same time, she was the very first witness on the very first day that prosecutors called. So it's really hard to divorce her from this. And let's be honest, this case would have been another Southside crime in Chicago had these not been relatives of Jennifer Hudson.
Do you feel, though, that at the end of the day that something was learned from this? Was this, or was it, in fact, just another trial, a sad and terrible and tragic as it is for the people directly affected? But do you think that is there anything transformative about this?
I think so. I went into this trial covering it thinking, okay, this is, you know, a pretty typical murder trial. What's there? But the longer I sat in the in the courtroom looking at Jennifer Hudson and how far she is from where her family currently is. I thought this gave a peek into the criminal justice system. And the defense tried to put Inglewood on trial. And her brother, Jason Hudson, who died, was also a crack dealer, as well as the convicted William Balfour. Mm-hmm. So you had all these elements come up during the trial. But ultimately, the jury didn't really care that the brother dealt drugs or that Inglewood is a violent neighborhood. They saw this as a domestic violence issue.
Natalie Morris, a reporter for member station WBEZ Chicago Public Radio, and she joined us from there. Natalie, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now it's time to open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine. That's something we do just about every week for interesting stories about the way we live now. Sunday was Mother's Day, of course. That's a day to show our moms just how much we appreciate them. But for many people, it's a bittersweet day, particularly for those whose mothers have passed away. Today, we speak with one woman about her quest to fulfill her mother's last wish, and that's a quest that's taken 10 years and counting. As Danielle Cease's mother struggled through her last days fighting terminal cancer, she told Danielle that she wanted her ashes to be spread at a special place from her childhood. It was a rock located in the mountains of Southern Virginia. And Danielle Cease writes about her mother and her search in My Mother's Ashes, a story featured in this week's Post magazine, and she's with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
You know, you start this story thinking it's going to be kind of a madcap adventure. You know, one hears sort of funny stories about trying to find a place, a final resting place for ashes, and you think it's going to be easy. But this one, first of all, the story isn't a mad, it's an adventure, but it's actually a very poignant one. And it was harder than you thought it was going to be. So first of all, tell us a little bit about your mom and your relationship with her. She was a really special lady.
She was very special. And I think a lot of people found her special. She was an unusual person. And her approach to mothering was different from most. I mean, she was more a friend, I think, than traditional mom role. You know, she was... We like to do adventurous things together.
Well, she broke the mold in a lot of ways. In fact, she became an engineer and went back to school to become an engineer at a time when a lot of moms, especially single moms, didn't do that. And she was a woman in a male-dominated field. And
it was difficult for her. She didn't talk about it a lot. You know, I know she experienced a lot of difficulties in school and in work with the male chauvinism and things that you didn't really discuss. You know, it was just sort of like, unspoken. That's one of the reasons why she maybe didn't encourage me so much to get into engineering when I was in school.
But she was kind of your hero.
You
recognized her for being as brave as she was and as forward-thinking as she was. Well, why was this particular rock so special? Why was that the place that she wanted to have as her final resting place?
Well, she sort of lost her religion early in her life, and this was her holy place. This was the place where she would go to sort of feel the surroundings of nature, and that was a regular practice for her.
And was that a place that she would go to meditate? And to...
Yes.
Okay, so this is the point at which some people may be asking, okay, so why was it so hard to find this rock? I'm sure there are a lot of big rocks in Virginia, but it's been 10 years and you still haven't been able to find the rock?
We didn't look year after year. We looked for a few years, and then I realized that we're just going to have to take a different approach because, we'd covered just about as much territory as we could based on the information that we had. And a part of it was, me not wanting to part with her ashes. And so I was a little, hesitant to go back at some points. It was like I just didn't want to get rid of them.
I think that is part of the story that a lot of people will relate to. Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, there's something about—now, everyone obviously doesn't practice cremation. I mean, for some people, the burial of the physical body is an important part of their leave-taking. It's perhaps an important part of their spiritual practice. But for first of all, your mother is very practical. She didn't want all that. But then for you and then for your brother, what was the meaning that took on kind of living with the physical presence of her? Why do you think that became so important?
We had both been raised Roman Catholic. We weren't used to having, our deceased loved ones cremated. We were used to a more traditional burial practice. And I think that I didn't expect it to be that difficult. But, it was something that I've always respected. I thought that, I found cremation to be a better practice. And, I'm practical in the same way that my mother is as far as that goes. It just seems more realistic when we have such limited space these days for burial. And It's expensive. Both my brother and I became attached to the ashes in ways that we didn't expect to be. And then I don't know. It made it a lot more difficult to try and part with them, try and take them and spread them.
You were an adult when you lost your mother. And I think that that is something that people might feel a sense of shame around, that they were so undone by the death of a parent. Exactly. You know, that is the normal course of things, that children are meant to bury their parents, and that we often think of it as this huge tragedy when it's the other way around, which of course it is when it's the other way around. Could you just talk a little bit about that, just how profoundly your mother's death affected you?
Whatever your age, I don't think you're ever ready to deal with the death of a parent. I don't think that's something that people realize until they come to it, that it's a lot more profound than, you know, than you would expect. And for me, a lot of it was that, you know, I suffered from serious depression at the time. I was going through a rough time with that. And my mother was sort of a stabilizing force in my life. Even when I wasn't around her a lot, just knowing she was there, you know, knowing that you have that parent to rely on. And, you know, having her go was just devastating in that sense of losing that security. So there was that. And also just this sense that the unfairness of it, that, you know, she was so young and she had just gotten to a stage in her life where she felt, you know, like she could enjoy herself. You know, she'd had such a rough life, and there was such a grave injustice in it for me that she would have to. And after having such, you know, after being depressed for so long and, you know, having suicidal thoughts, there was a guilt involved for me as well, of thinking, you know, here I am wanting to die so much of the time, and, you know, here she is giving up her life. And I wanted to trade places with her. It's just like I wanted to, you know, take on her suffering. I wanted to be the one that was going. So it was particularly difficult from that perspective.
Is it hard to talk about even now? It seems that it is.
It is, yes. I appreciate that. It is somewhat difficult still to think about. Some of those feelings remain.
What was it like writing this piece then about that, and kind of laying out just all of the, both of the, if I may say, the kind of the funnier aspects of it, which a lot of people can relate to. It's actually been a theme in some movies, like what to do with the ashes of a loved one, and when they have very specific requests, but also your own struggle and pain about it, around it. What's it been like to write that?
It was actually really, I learned a lot about myself, and it was very cathartic in some ways. It was very difficult as well. And when I started, I wanted it to be sort of a humorous piece. I wanted to have a lighter take on, you know, as you say, you know, there's so many funny stories about ashes. But as I got into it, I realized that there were all these emotions that were surfacing, and there was just so much. And I had to be as honest as I could with it, and it came out a bit more weighty than first intended.
Were you still looking for that rock? Are you still looking for
Still looking for that rock, yes. Although, you know, maybe have some leads on it now, so hope you'll follow up to the saga, perhaps.
Danielle Cease is a writer and editorial aide at The Washington Post. Her story, My Mother's Ashes, was featured in this week's Washington Post magazine. It's called, appropriately enough, My Mother's Ashes. And Danielle was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Danielle, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me here. It's been an honor.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we want to go behind closed doors. That's the part of the program where we talk about issues that many people often talk about only in private. Today, though, we want to swing open the door on weight. Now, who hasn't said, I shouldn't have eaten that cupcake, or I should go to the gym more? But there's also a lot about controlling weight that people are ashamed to talk about. And now there's a new study that's caught a lot of attention. 42% of Americans are now projected to be obese by the year 2030. That, according to the American Journal of Preventative Medicine. And that sounds like a shocking number, but African Americans have already passed that mark. 44% are obese, according to the Centers for Disease Control. And obesity rates are high among Latinos as well. And we wanted to talk more about this. So we've called Janae Desmond-Harris. She is a staff writer for The Root. That's a news and commentary site with an African American perspective. They've just launched a year-long series on Blacks and obesity. Also with us is Jane Delgado. She is the CEO of the National Alliance for Hispanic Health. She's the author of a number of books, including The Latina Guide to Health. She's a trained psychotherapist, and she's also with us often to talk about health issues. I welcome you both. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
I am thrilled, as always, to be with you, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having us.
Janae, let me start with you. Why did The Root decide to launch this series? What do you hope to accomplish with it?
Well, in light of some of the statistics that you mentioned about obesity among all Americans and African Americans, as well as the First Lady's focus on combating childhood obesity, we really wanted to get this conversation going in a way that went beyond, oh my God, Black people are so fat and they're getting fatter, it's terrible, what are we going to do? We wanted to add a little more perspective and nuance as far as the nature of the problem and the solutions.
What are some of the kinds of things you want to explore?
Well, we even want to take a step all the way back and say, is there really a problem? And if it is, we want to know what's causing it on an individual level, but also on a systemic level. And we want to look at solutions that can be implemented in both ways.
Jane Delgado, I should mention that we've spoken with you about this issue before. You don't even like the term obesity. You prefer the term excess weight. Could you talk a little bit about why that is?
Well, one of the things that is happening in the sciences is that we're learning that excess weight may be a consequence of illness, of an endocrine system that's not working, so that the fact that someone tends to gain weight may be because their endocrine system is out of balance, and there's more and more evidence to this effect. Additionally, different kinds of people have different kinds of body frames, which means what's BMI good for one person may not be good for another person.
BMI being body mass index.
Right. And you know, in the NIH tables, for example, it very clearly says that for African American, it overstates what is obese. So that people should not be considered obese, but they still have the tables and everybody uses them.
What is your take on the numbers that we are citing that suggest that 44% of African Americans have excess weight, that something like 30%, is it, of Latinos have excess weight, and that overall that the numbers seem to be inching higher for Americans in general? What, in your view, is driving this?
Well, first of all, remember that Hispanics and African Americans have always had more excess weight. But Hispanics live longer than non-Hispanic whites and have less heart disease. So the very things that people are concerned about that causes excess weight is not true in our community. The question is, why do people have excess weight? When does it become a problem and how to fix it? And the thing which is most discouraging to me is this view in America that if you are overweight, it's because you're lazy, you're not trying, and you really don't have the will to do it. When in fact, sometimes it's very hard to change.
As a person, as a healthcare provider yourself, are you encouraged or discouraged by the renewed focus that we seem to be placing on weight?
When Surgeon General Satcher was the Surgeon General, he's the one who started this whole issue in looking at excess weight. Way back then, I told David, I said, David, women have always been concerned about their weight. We've got to do something to build people's self-esteem and self-image so that they feel good about themselves and do the kinds of things they need to do. So it's been a long history of following this as a trend. And now, unfortunately, obesity has become a funding source in the health area. That if you're doing something in obesity, foundations, you know, corporations, all sorts of people want to jump at your door to say, oh, yes, let me help you. But it's not necessarily the right people.
But isn't it the case, though, that there are more deaths associated with illnesses that are associated with excess weight than there are deaths associated with smoking? I mean, isn't that the case now?
No, because the difference is with smoking, we know that smoking causes a carcinogen to go into your body. With excess weight, people are very careful because we don't know whether the excess weight is a cause of the illness or a consequence of it. And that's the big science question that people are looking at now.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going behind closed doors to talk about weight. I'm speaking with Jane Delgado. She is the CEO of the National Alliance for Hispanic Health and the author of a number of books about health. Also with us, Janae Desmond-Harris, staff writer at The Root. She's launching a year-long series on African Americans and obesity. Janae Desmond-Harris, a recent op-ed by Alice Randall, who's an African American writer, has been getting a lot of buzz. She wrote in the New York Times that, quote, many black women are fat because we want to be, unquote. And she argues that there are a lot of cultural issues at work. One of them is that there's a cultural preference for women to be larger size in the African-American community. This has set off a lot of discussion. What are you hearing about that argument?
Yeah, we have sort of participated in and helped to curate a conversation around that particular piece, which I think is about some bigger issues. There's a lot of frustration with what Ms. Randall said. I think because of the perception that she was speaking about her own anecdotal experience, which may be true. You know, she mentioned that in her view, being overweight was a source of political resistance against the image of the fit slave. Those things were brand new to a lot of people. Like, a lot of black women had not heard those before and they didn't sound familiar. So there was a lot of pushback. But I think in a bigger sense, the upset about it was about this real frustration we have as African-Americans, and particularly as African-American women, as being portrayed as a monolith. We're all the same. If there's something wrong, there's one cause and there's one solution. And people are sick and tired of that when it comes to relationships, when it comes to other issues, and increasingly so when it comes to this issue of weight and obesity.
Where are you going to try to take this conversation in a way that hopefully will not irritate people and make them feel once again that they're reduced to one dimension?
We're talking to people from a variety of different perspectives, from health professionals to personal trainers to, you know, sociologists, who all have different ideas about what's causing the high rates of obesity or excess weight among African Americans. And ultimately, our goal is for people to listen to the solutions and hopefully have a healthier community.
Jane Delgado, you know, one of the things that's interesting, though, that the surveys show that African Americans and Latinas as a whole are statistically carrying more weight. Women are carrying more weight, but like their bodies more.
Isn't that wonderful?
Well, is it?
It is. You know, one of the things that produces like body fat, like in your belly, for women is stress. When you are under stress, your brain produces more cortisol, gives you more belly fat. I think that for women, the Hispanic women and African American women, to have a good self-image, that's a good thing. We should be happy about that. The problem I feel bad is for a lot of non-Hispanic white women who suffer with anorexia and all sorts of body image dysfunctions because they don't have those images. But the thing is, each woman, regardless of her size, has to be as healthy and fit as she can be. That's a different thing for every person. Regardless of race, ethnicity, she's got to find that spot where she can be happy, whatever that is. And that's where the work is.
But there are those who argue, though, that on the whole, despite the fact that excess weight has become such a part of the conversation, the national part of the conversation, Americans on the whole and ethnic minorities, particularly blacks and Latinos, are in denial about it because our entire sort of culture has not kind of embraced to promote more healthy living, you know, more exercise, healthier diet, and so forth. There are those who argue that we think we can kind of pray it away or we can, but not.
No, no? I don't think so, Michelle, because, for example, it is rare the woman I speak to who tells me she's okay with her weight and size. So I think that across the board, as women in America, we're in a society that tells us one thing. Look, if you look at Hispanic women on television, there is not one that has excess weight. They're all like sexy, voluptuous, and our Secret Service scandal did not help us at all. You know, that's the reality. It just fit into that kind of awful image that we as Latinas don't like to have. But, you know,
But if you look at a lot of the TV stars and African-American TV stars now, or stars even in you know, it's got to be, Janae, I don't know how you feel about this, but often it's got to be the kind of the sassy,
right,
big girl who's voracious and can sing, of course.
I mean, right, and know. I also want
to
point out
that everybody's not in love with that.
You know, when it comes to this sort of assumed thing that we talk about, that black women and Latino women are more accepting of larger bodies, I think we should take a step back and realize that there's a lot of gray area between celebrating being curvy, like Beyonce, and, you know, being totally okay with a body that's carrying so much extra weight that it may or may not be causing you serious health issues and affecting your ability to live your life. And I think those two things get lumped in together. People say, you know, women of color are fine with their bodies. They love extra weight. No wonder they're dying of diabetes. And I think there's really a lot more detail there that needs to be looked at. And that's a real source of frustration when we talk about this, is that all gets sort of like lumped together.
Well, why don't you tell us where you're going to go next? And then Jane Delgado, I'll give you the last word about where you'd like us to go next.
Actually, I have an interview coming up that I think Jane would actually appreciate. It's an African-American woman who's a blogger who's a part of the fat acceptance movement. And so she's really resisting any notion that we should try to control or comment on each other's bodies. And she absolutely believes that you can be fit and healthy while being a size that society would consider overweight. So that's something that will probably round out our series a bit.
Okay. Jane Delgado, where would you like this conversation to go?
In two ways. Where, first, I want women to be more accepting of their bodies and be healthy and fit. You know, people talk about skinny fat being a problem. We also want people to know that it's okay to be healthy fat. But the most important thing is I'd like people to seriously look at environmental factors like endocrine disruptors and what they're doing to us, not just in terms of obesity and excess weight and whatever you want to call it, but also how come African-American and Hispanic girls are reaching puberty younger. I think it's all connected, and we really have to look at the bigger picture of what's happening to our lives. How has our environment changed so much in the last 30 years that our bodies are now responding?
What about food supply and the quality and availability of food, is that also an issue?
That's a separate issue because obviously the food we eat is very important. Also the selection of food. There are many, many factors to this. You know, when we talk about excess weight, we talk about 10 things that you can do to be healthy. One of them is your food selection. There are a lot of other things you have to do too.
Jane Delgado is the CEO of the National Alliance for Hispanic Health. She's the author of a number of books, including The Latina Guide to Health. She's a trained psychotherapist and a frequent guest on this program to talk about health issues. Janae Desmond-Harris is a staff writer for The Root. That's an African-American news and commentary site. And they were kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now it's time for the occasional feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we talk with some of our guests about the music they love. Today we get the personal playlist of S. Epatha Merkerson. She's the award-winning actress best known for her role as Lieutenant Anita Van Buren on Law & Order. She spoke with us about her latest series, Find Our Missing. The program spotlights the cases of missing people of color who are in fact overrepresented among the cases of missing persons, but whose circumstances often don't seem to attract media attention. But on a happier note, here's what's playing in her ear.
Hi, this is S. Epatha Merkerson, and this is what's in my ear. Black Narcissus, Joe Henderson, big band, beautiful song. I just love the melody, and whenever I need to calm down and put my thoughts in order, Black Narcissus is a song that I tend to play. I'm just like a huge Chaka Khan fan, and so I would probably go to Melody Lingers On. Combination of rhythm and blues and Night in Tunisia. And she actually has Dizzy Gillespie playing on it. One song I'm listening to is Katrina's Eyes by Christian Scott. Just beautifully rendered, and I believe it's a story of the hurricane as well, and so you feel it in the music. You feel this sort of slow pacing of the water coming. You feel the devastation, and you feel the strength of the people in the song. I think he's an incredible artist, Christian Scott. I also listen to Joni Mitchell, Blue.
Blue. Songs are like tattoos, you know I've been to see before.
Joni Mitchell just chills you out.
Hey, Blue, there is a song for you.
So there are a few things that have been in my ear lately.
That was the award-winning actress S. Epatha Merkerson of Law & Order fame and the host of the TV One series Find Our Missing, telling us what's playing in her ear. To listen to my previous conversation with her, please go to npr.org and click on the Programs tab for Tell Me More. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.